Liberty by John Stuart Mill, first published in 1859. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Second half of Chapter 2, Liberty of Thought and Discussion. So much for the argument based on the premise that the publicly accepted opinions may be false. I now turn to the other strand in the argument, and assume those opinions to be true. On that basis, let us look into the value of how they are likely to be held, given that their truth is not freely and openly discussed, pro and con. A person with a strong opinion may be unwilling to admit that his opinion might be false, but even he ought to be moved by this thought. However true it may be, if it isn't fully, frequently, and fearlessly discussed, it will be held as a dead dogma rather than as a living truth. There are people, fortunately fewer than there used to be, who will be satisfied if you assent undoubtingly to something they think is true, even if you have no knowledge whatever of the grounds for the belief in question, and couldn't defend it decently against the most superficial objections. When they get their creed to be taught as authoritative, they naturally think that no good and some harm will come from allowing it to be questioned. Where their influence is dominant, they make it nearly impossible for the publicly accepted opinion to be rejected wisely and considerately. It may still be rejected rashly and ignorantly, for it is seldom possible to shut off discussion entirely. And once discussion gets started, beliefs held as creeds, rather than based on reasons, are apt to give way before the slightest semblance of an argument. And suppose that the true opinion is not vanquished in argument, and remains in the believer's mind. It sits there as a prejudice, a belief that owes nothing to argument, and isn't vulnerable to argument. This isn't the way truth ought to be held by a rational being. This is not knowing the truth. Truth, when accepted in that way, is merely one more superstition, clinging to words that happen to express a genuine truth. Protestants, at least, don't deny that the intellect and judgment of mankind ought to be helped to grow and flourish. If this is to be done, what more appropriate method is there than for the person to employ his intellect and judgment on the things that concern him so much, that it is considered necessary for him to hold opinions on them? The cultivation of the understanding involves, more perhaps than anything else, learning the grounds of one's own opinions. When people believe something on a topic on which it is highly important to believe rightly, they ought to be able to defend it at least against the common objections. This may be said. Let them be taught what the grounds are for their opinions. Just because they never hear the opinions being disputed, it doesn't follow that they are merely parroting them. Persons who learn geometry don't simply commit the theorems to memory, but understand and remember the demonstrations. And it would be absurd to say that they remain ignorant of the grounds of geometrical truths, because they never hear anyone deny them and try to disprove them. Undoubtedly. And such teaching suffices in a subject like mathematics, where there is nothing to be said on the wrong side. That's what is special about the evidentness of mathematical truths. All the argument is on one side. There are no objections, and no answers to objections. But on every subject where difference of opinion is possible, the truth depends on striking a balance between two sets of conflicting reasons. Even in natural science, there is always some other possible explanation of the same facts. Some theory with the earth instead of the sun at the center, some theory explaining combustion in terms of phlogiston rather than of oxygen. And it has to be shown why that other theory can't be the true one. Until this is shown, and we know how it is shown, we don't understand the grounds for accepting the theory that we do accept. But when we turn to infinitely more complicated subjects, to morals, religion, politics, social relations, and the business of life, three-quarters of the arguments for every controversial opinion consists in explaining away the apparent evidence for some rival opinion. The second greatest of the ancient orators has left it on record that he always studied his adversary's case as intensely as he did his own, if not even more so. What Cicero, the orator in question, practised as the means of success in the law courts, should be imitated by anyone who studies any subject in order to arrive at the truth. He who knows only his own side of the case doesn't know much about it. His reasons may be good, and no one may have been able to refute them. But if he is equally unable to refute the reasons on the opposite side, and doesn't even know what they are, he has no ground for preferring either opinion. The rational position for him would be to suspend judgment, and if he doesn't settle for that, he is either being led by authority or, like most people, adopting the side he feels most strongly drawn to. It isn't enough that he should hear the arguments of opponents from his own teachers, presented in their way and accompanied by their refutations. That isn't how to do justice to the opposing arguments, or to bring them into real contact with his own mind. He must be able to hear them from people who actually believe them, who defend them in earnest, and do their very best for them. If he doesn't know them in their most plausible and persuasive form, and doesn't feel the whole force of the difficulty that his view of the subject has to encounter and dispose of, he will never really possess the portion of truth that meets and removes that difficulty. 99% of supposedly educated men are in this condition, even of those who can argue fluently for their opinions. Perhaps their conclusion is true, but it might be false, for all they know. They haven't put themselves in the mental position of those who think differently from them, and considered what such opponents may have to say, and consequently they don't, in any proper sense of the word, know the doctrine that they themselves proclaim. They don't know the parts of it that explain and justify the rest. They don't know the considerations that reconcile an apparent theoretical conflict, or that show which of two apparently strong reasons ought to be preferred. They are strangers to all that part of the truth that tips the balance, and decides how a completely informed mind should judge, and won't ever be really known except by those who have attended equally and impartially to both sides, and tried to see the reasons for both in the strongest light. This discipline is essential to a real understanding of moral and human subjects, so much so that if any important truth doesn't have any opponents, we must imagine them, and supply them with the strongest arguments that the most skilful prosecutor can come up with. To lessen the force of these considerations, an enemy of free discussion might say this: there is no need for mankind in general to know and understand all that can be said against or for their opinions by philosophers and theologians. There is no need for common people to be able to expose all the misstatements or fallacies of an ingenious opponent. It is enough if there is always somebody capable of answering them, so that anything that is likely to mislead uneducated persons will be refuted. Simple minds, having been taught the obvious grounds of the truths they have learned, may trust to authority for the rest. They are aware that they have neither knowledge nor talent to resolve every difficulty that can be raised, and can feel secure in the thought that all the difficulties that have been raised have been, or can be, answered by those who are specially trained for that task. What I am up against here are people who don't demand that belief in a truth should be accompanied by much understanding of it. Well, for purposes of argument, I shall concede to them that the preceding line of thought is right. I'll let them have as much of it as they could possibly claim. Even with that much conceded, the argument for free discussion is in no way weakened. For even this doctrine acknowledges that mankind ought to have a rational assurance that all objections have been satisfactorily answered. And how can they be answered if they haven't been uttered? Also, how can an answer be known to be satisfactory if the objectors have no opportunity to show that it isn't? If not the public, then at least the philosophers and theologians who are to resolve the difficulties must become familiar with them in their most challenging form. And this can't happen unless the difficulties are freely stated and placed in the most advantageous possible light. The Catholic Church has its own way of dealing with this embarrassing problem. It draws a line separating those who are allowed to receive its doctrines, through becoming convinced of them, from those who must take them on trust. Neither group is allowed any choice as to what they will accept. But such of the clergy as can be fully trusted are allowed, and even encouraged, to make themselves acquainted with the arguments of opponents in order to answer them. So they are permitted to read heretical books. Lay people may not do this without special permission, which is hard to obtain. This system recognizes that it is beneficial for teachers to know the enemy's case, but finds a way of combining this with a denial of such knowledge to the rest of the world, thus giving to the elite more mental culture than it allows to the mass, though not more mental freedom. By this device, it succeeds in obtaining the kind of mental superiority that its purposes require. For although culture without freedom never made a large and liberal mind, it can make a clever advocate of a cause. But in Protestant countries, this resource isn't available, because Protestants hold, at least in theory, that the responsibility for choosing a religion must be borne by each person for himself, and can't be passed off onto teachers. Besides, in the present state of the world, it is practically impossible that writings read by the instructed can be kept from the uninstructed. If mankind's teachers are to know all that they ought to know, everything must be free to be written and published without restraint. Here is something that might be thought. When the publicly accepted opinions are true, if the harm done by the absence of free discussion of them were merely that men don't know the grounds of those opinions, this may be an intellectual evil, but it isn't a moral one. It doesn't affect the value of the opinions, so far as their influence on character is concerned. In fact, however, the absence of discussion leads men to forget not only the grounds for an opinion, but too often also its meaning. The words it is expressed in cease to suggest ideas, or suggest only a small portion of the ideas they originally expressed. Instead of a vivid conception and a living belief, there remain only a few phrases learned by heart, or if any part of the meaning is retained, it is only the shell and husk of it, the finer essence being lost. This fact fills a great chapter in human history, one that cannot be too earnestly studied and meditated on. It is illustrated in the experience of almost all ethical doctrines and religious creeds. They are all full of meaning and vitality to those who originate them and to their immediate disciples. As long as a doctrine or creed is struggling to rise above other creeds, its meaning continues to be felt as strongly as, and perhaps even more strongly than, it was at the outset. Eventually, either it prevails and becomes the general opinion, or its progress stops, in which case it holds the ground it has gained, but doesn't spread any further. When either of these results has become apparent, controversy about the doctrine slackens and gradually dies away. The doctrine has taken its place as a publicly accepted opinion, or as one of the recognized sects or divisions of opinion. Most of its present adherents have inherited it, rather than being convinced of it by reasons, and they don't worry much about anyone's being converted from their doctrine to some other, because such conversions are so rare. At first they were constantly on the alert, either to defend themselves against the world, or to bring it over to their side. But now they have subsided into a passive state in which they don't, if they can help it, listen to arguments against their creed, and don't confront dissentients, if there are any, with arguments in its favour. It is usually at about this stage in its history that the doctrine starts to lose its living power. We often hear teachers of all creeds lamenting how hard it is to keep up in believers' minds a lively awareness of the truth they pay lip service to, so that the truth may penetrate their feelings and govern their conduct. No such difficulty is complained of while the creed is still fighting for its existence. At that stage, even the weaker combatants know and feel what they are fighting for, and how it differs from other doctrines. and at that same stage in any creed's existence, a good many people bring its fundamental principles to bear on all the forms of thought, weigh and consider them in all their important bearings, and experience the full effect on their characters which belief in that creed ought to produce in a mind thoroughly saturated with it. But when the creed has come to be hereditary, and to be accepted passively rather than actively, when the mind is no longer as compelled as it once was to exercise its vital powers on the questions raised by its belief, there's a progressive tendency to forget all of the belief, except the words expressing it, or to give it a dull and lethargic assent, as though by taking it on trust one freed oneself from any need to make it real in one's mind, or test it by personal experience, until it comes to have almost no connection with the person's inner life. Then there are the cases, almost the majority these days, where the creed remains, as it were, outside the mind, like a hard shell protecting it against anything else that might be directed to the higher parts of our nature, manifesting its power by not letting any fresh and living conviction get in, but itself doing nothing for the mind or heart, except standing guard to keep them vacant. Doctrines intrinsically fitted to make the deepest impression on the mind can remain in it as dead beliefs, without ever becoming real in the imagination, the feelings, or the understanding. And an example of the extent to which this can happen is provided by how the majority of believers hold the doctrines of Christianity. By Christianity, I here mean what is counted as such by all churches and sects, the maxims and injunctions contained in the New Testament. These are regarded as sacred, and accepted as laws by all professing Christians, and yet hardly one Christian in 1,000 guides or tests his individual conduct by reference to them. The standard to which the typical Christian does refer his conduct is the custom of his nation, his class, or the members of his church. So he has, on one hand, a collection of ethical maxims which he believes to have been delivered to him by infallible wisdom as rules to govern himself by, and on the other, a set of everyday judgments and practices which go a certain distance with some of those maxims, go a shorter distance with others, stand in direct opposition to some, and are, on the whole, a compromise between the Christian creed and the interests and suggestions of worldly life. He pays lip service to the first of these standards, but the one he actually steers by is the second. All Christians believe that the blessed are the poor and humble, and those who are ill-used by the world, that it is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven, that they should not judge lest they be judged, that they should never swear, that they should love their neighbour as themselves, that if someone takes their cloak, they should give him their coat also, that they should take no thought for what the next day will bring, that if they want to be perfect, they should sell all their belongings and give the proceeds of the sale to the poor. They aren't insincere when they say they believe these things. They do believe them in the way that people believe what they have always heard praised and never heard discussed. But in the sense of belief, which refers to the living belief that regulates conduct, they believe these doctrines up to the point where it is usual to act on them, and no further. The doctrines, taken whole as undivided lumps, have two recognized uses: to throw at opponents, and to put forward, when possible, as people's reasons for doing things they think are praiseworthy. But if you've reminded typical Christians that the maxims require countless things that they never even think of doing, you would merely be classified with those nasty folk who claim to be better than other people. The doctrines have no hold on ordinary believers. They aren't a power in their minds. The believers have an habitual respect for the sound of them, but have no feeling that spreads from the words to the meanings, forcing the mind to take them in, and make the believer's conduct conform to the formula. When it's a question of how to behave, the believer looks around for Mr. A and Mr. B to tell him how far to go in obeying Christ. We can be sure that with the early Christians, the situation was very different from this. if it had then been the way it is now, Christianity would never have expanded from an obscure sect of the despised Hebrews into the religion of the Roman Empire. When their enemies said, "See how these Christians love one another," a remark not likely to be made by anybody now, the Christians assuredly had a much livelier sense of the meaning of their creed than they have had ever since. This lack of lively inner conviction on the part of most Christians is probably the main reason why Christianity now makes so little progress in extending its domain, and after 18 centuries is still mostly confined to Europeans and their descendants. Even with strictly religious people who are in earnest about their doctrines and attach much more meaning to them than people in general do, it commonly happens that this comparatively active religious component in their minds comes from Calvin or Knox, or some such person much nearer in character to themselves. The sayings of Christ sit passively in their minds, producing hardly any effect beyond what is caused by merely listening to such amiable and bland words. Doctrines that are the badge of one particular sect retain more of their vitality than do ones common to all recognized sects, and teachers take more trouble to keep the meaning of the former alive. One reason for this is that a doctrine special to one sect is more questioned and must be defended more often against open opponents. Both teachers and learners fall asleep at their post when there is no enemy to be guarded against. The same thing holds true, generally speaking, of all traditional doctrines, not just those of morals and religion, but also doctrines about what it is prudent to do and how to go about living your life. All languages and literatures are full of general observations on life, what it is and how to live it. Observations that everybody knows, that everybody repeats or hears and agrees to, that are accepted as truisms, but which most people don't really know the meaning of, until it is made real to them by experience, generally of a painful kind. It often happens that someone suffering from an unforeseen misfortune or disappointment calls to mind some proverb or common saying that has been familiar to him all his life, and that would have saved him from the calamity if he had ever felt its meaning as he does now. There are indeed reasons for this, other than the absence of discussion. There are many truths whose full meaning can't be made real in the mind until personal experience has brought it home. But even with these, much more of the meaning would have been understood, and what was understood would have been far more deeply impressed on the mind if the man had been accustomed to hear it argued, pro and con, by people who did understand it. The fatal tendency of mankind to give up thinking about something when it is no longer doubtful is the cause of half their errors. You might ask, is the absence of unanimity required for true knowledge? Is it the case that for any part of mankind to realize the truth, some other part must persist in error? Does a belief stop being real and living as soon as it is generally accepted, and is a proposition never thoroughly understood and felt unless some doubt about it remains? As soon as mankind have unanimously accepted a truth, does the truth perish within them? It has always been thought that the highest aim and best result of improved intelligence is to unite mankind increasingly in the acknowledgement of all important truths. Does this intelligence last only as long as it hasn't achieved its aim? Do the fruits of conquest perish because of the very completeness of the victory? I affirm no such thing. As mankind improve, the number of doctrines no longer disputed or doubted will constantly increase, and the well-being of mankind could almost be measured by the number and importance of the truths that reach the point of being uncontested. The ending of serious controversy on one question after another is a necessary aspect of the consolidation of opinion, and such consolidation is as healthy in the case of true opinions as it is dangerous and poisonous when the opinions are wrong. But although this gradual lessening of the area of disagreement is necessary, in both senses of the term, being at once inevitable and absolutely needed, it doesn't follow that all its consequences are beneficial. The need to explain a truth to its opponents, or to defend it against them, is an important aid to the intelligent and living grasp of it, and the loss of that aid is a disadvantage of its being accepted by everyone and thus having no opponents. It isn't enough to outweigh the benefit of universal recognition of a truth, but still it's a real drawback. Where this advantage can no longer be had, I would like to see the teachers of mankind try to provide a substitute for it, some device for making the difficulties of the doctrine as vivid in the learner's mind as if they were being urged by someone trying to convert him to an opposing doctrine. But instead of looking for ways to do this, the teachers have lost the instructive devices they formerly had. The Socratic method of inquiry through argument and counter-argument, so splendidly displayed in Plato's Dialogues, was a device of the sort I am recommending. The dialogues were essentially a negative discussion of the great questions of philosophy and life, directed with enormous skill toward someone who had merely adopted publicly accepted commonplaces, to convince him that he didn't understand the subject and didn't yet attach any definite meaning to the doctrines he proclaimed, so that in becoming aware of his ignorance, the pupil might be steered towards a stable belief, resting on a clear grasp both of the meaning of doctrines and of the grounds for them. The formal debates in the universities of the Middle Ages had a somewhat similar purpose. They were intended to ensure that the pupil understood his own opinion, and the opposing opinion could enforce the grounds of his and refute those of the other. These medieval debates had indeed an incurable defect, namely that the premises appealed to were taken from authority and not from reason, and they were nothing like as good a discipline for the mind as were the powerful dialectics that shaped the intellects of Socrates' companions. But the modern mind owes far more to both than it is generally willing to admit, and the present methods of education contain nothing that even slightly replaces either of them. A person who gets all his instruction from teachers or books is under no compulsion to hear both sides, with the result that it is quite unusual, even among thinkers, for someone to know both sides, and the weakest part of everyone's defence of his own opinion is what he has prepared as a reply to opponents. It is currently fashionable to belittle negative logic, the kind that points out weaknesses in theory or errors in practice without establishing positive truths. Such negative criticism would indeed be a pretty poor final result, but it is enormously valuable as a means to getting any positive knowledge or belief worthy of the name. And until people are again systematically trained in it, there will be few great thinkers, and a low average level of intellect in all branches of learning and research, except mathematics and the physical sciences. On any other subject, a person's opinions deserve to be called knowledge only to the extent that he has, either on his own initiative or forced by others, gone through the mental process he would have needed in an active controversy with opponents. When we don't have controversy, it is sorely missed and difficult to create artificially. So how absurd it is, how worse than absurd, to deprive oneself of it when it occurs spontaneously. If there are people who dispute a publicly accepted opinion, or who will dispute it if not prevented by law or social pressure, let us thank them for it, open our minds to listen to them, and rejoice that someone will do for us what we otherwise would have to do, or ought to do, much more laboriously for ourselves. There is yet another powerful reason why diversity of opinion can be advantageous, a reason that will hold good until mankind reaches an intellectual level far above its present one. We have so far considered only two possibilities: that the publicly accepted opinion is false, and therefore some other opinion is true, and that the publicly accepted opinion is true, but a conflict with the opposite error is essential to a clear grasp and deep feeling of its truth. However, there is a commoner case than either of these, namely, the conflicting doctrines share the truth between them, and a minority opinion is needed to provide the remainder of the truth, of which the publicly accepted doctrine captures only a part. On matters other than plain empirical fact, popular opinions are often true, but are seldom or never the whole truth. They are a part of the truth, sometimes a large part, sometimes a small, but exaggerated, distorted, and torn apart from other truths that ought to accompany and set limits to them. Minority opinions, on the other hand, are generally some of these suppressed and neglected truths, bursting the bonds that kept them down, and either seeking reconciliation with the truth contained in the common opinion, or confronting it as enemies, and setting themselves up as the whole truth. The latter case has always been the most frequent, because in the human mind one-sidedness has always been the rule, and many-sidedness the exception. Hence, even in revolutions of opinion, one part of the truth usually sets, while another rises, like the setting and rising of the sun in the earth's daily revolutions. Even progress, which ought to add truth to truth, usually only substitutes one partial and incomplete truth for another. And any improvement this brings comes mainly from the fact that the new fragment of truth is better suited to the needs of the time than the one it displaces. Even when a prevailing opinion is basically true, it will be so partial that a rival opinion embodying some part of the truth that it omits should be considered precious, however much error and confusion it blends in with its portion of truth. No reasonable person will be indignant because those who force us to notice truths we would otherwise have overlooked do themselves overlook some truths that we see. Rather, a reasonable person will think that so long as popular truth is one-sided, it is more desirable than regrettable that unpopular truth should have one-sided defenders too, because the one-sided ones are usually the most energetic and the most likely to compel attention to the fragment of wisdom they are proclaiming. Consider how things stood in the 18th century. Nearly all educated people, and all uneducated people led by them, were lost in admiration of what is called civilization, and of the marvels of modern science, literature, and philosophy, greatly exaggerating the unlikeness between modern men and ancient ones. They cherished the belief that the differences were entirely in their favour. What a healthy shock they received when the paradoxes of Rousseau exploded like bombshells in their midst. Rousseau's views broke up the compact mass of one-sided opinion and forced its elements to recombine in a better form, and with additional ingredients. It's not that the generally accepted opinions were, on the whole, further from the truth than Rousseau's were. On the contrary, they were nearer to it, containing more positive truth and much less error. Nevertheless, Rousseau's doctrine contained a considerable amount of exactly the truths lacking from the general opinion. These truths floated down the stream of opinion, and are the deposit that was left behind when the flood subsided. Since Rousseau wrote, cultivated minds have always made some room for the ideas of the superior worth of simplicity of life, and the enervating and demoralizing effect of the constraints and clutter and hypocrisies of artificial society. And in time these ideas will produce their due effect, though at present they have as much need to be asserted as they ever did, and asserted by deeds, because words on this subject have nearly exhausted their power. Another example. In politics, it is almost a commonplace that a healthy state of political life requires that there be a party of order or stability, and a party of progress or reform, until one or other of them enlarges its mental grasp enough to become a party equally of order and of progress, knowing what is fit to be preserved and what ought to be swept away. Each of these ways of thinking gets its usefulness from the deficiencies of the other, but also, to a great extent, is kept sane and reasonable by the opposition of the other. Consider the standing antagonisms of practical life, including democracy versus aristocracy, property versus equality, cooperation versus competition, luxury versus abstinence, sociality versus individuality, liberty versus discipline, and so on. Unless opinions favourable to each side of each of these are expressed with equal freedom, and pressed and defended with equal talent and energy, there is no chance that both the conflicting elements will get their due. One scale is sure to go up, and the other down. In the great practical concerns of life, truth is very much a matter of reconciling and combining opposites, so much so that few people have minds that are capacious and impartial enough to make the adjustment anywhere near correctly, so that it has to be made by the rough process of a struggle between combatants fighting under hostile banners. With any of the questions I have listed, if either of the two rival opinions has the better claim to be not merely tolerated but encouraged, it is the one that happens to be the minority opinion at a given time and place. That is the one that for the time being represents the neglected interests, the aspect of human well-being that risks obtaining less than its share. I am aware that in this country now there is no intolerance of differences of opinion on most of these topics. I bring them forward just as unquestionable examples of the universal fact that in the existing state of the human intellect, the only chance of fair play for all sides of the truth is through diversity of opinion. Even when the world is almost unanimous on some subject, and is right about it, people who disagree, if any are to be found, probably have something to say worth hearing, and truth would lose something by their silence. It may be objected, but some publicly accepted principles, especially on the highest and most vital subjects, are more than half-truths. Christian morality, for instance, is the whole truth on that subject. And anyone who teaches a morality that varies from it is wholly in error. This is in practice the most important of all the cases, so none can be better for testing the general maxim. But before pronouncing on what Christian morality is or is not, it would be desirable to decide what Christian morality means. If it means the morality of the New Testament, I'm surprised that anyone who knows about it from the book itself can suppose that it was announced or intended as a complete doctrine of morals. The Gospel's precepts all concern matters in respect of which a pre-existing morality was to be corrected or superseded by a wider and higher one. Also, these precepts are expressed in extremely general terms, and often can't possibly be interpreted literally. They have the impressiveness of poetry or eloquence rather than the precision of legislation. It has never been possible to extract a body of ethical doctrine from this without some input from the Old Testament, that is, from a system that is elaborate enough, but in many respects barbarous, and intended only for a barbarous people. St. Paul, a declared enemy to this Judaic mode of interpreting and fleshing out the doctrine of his master, also assumes a pre-existing morality, but a different one, namely that of the Greeks and Romans, and his advice to Christians is largely a system of coming to terms with that, even to the extent of seeming to endorse slavery. What is called Christian morality, but should rather be termed theological morality, was not the work of Christ or the apostles, but is of much later origin. It was gradually built up by the Catholic Church of the first 5 centuries. And though moderns and Protestants don't automatically accept it as authoritative, they have modified it much less than might have been expected. They have mostly contented themselves with replacing the parts that had been added in the Middle Ages by different additions of their own, selected according to the character and tendencies of the sect making the additions. I would be the last person to deny that mankind owes a great debt to this morality, and to its early teachers, but I don't hesitate to say that in many important respects it is incomplete and one-sided, and that if ideas and feelings from outside it had not contributed to the formation of European life and character, human affairs would have been in a worse condition than they are now. Christian morality, so called, has all the marks of a reaction. It is to a large extent a protest against paganism. Its ideal is innocence, rather than nobleness, and abstinence from evil, rather than energetic pursuit of good. and this means that its ideal is negative rather than positive, and passive rather than active. It has been well said that in its precepts, "Thou shalt not," predominates unduly over "Thou shalt." In its horror of the pleasures of the senses, it made an idol of asceticism, which has been gradually trimmed down into a mere idol of rule-following. In holding out the hope of heaven and the threat of hell as the official and appropriate motives for a virtuous life, this morality falls far below the best of the ancients, and does what it can to make human morality essentially selfish, by disconnecting each man's feelings of duty from the interests of his fellow creatures, except when he is given a self-interested reason to attend to them. It is essentially a doctrine of passive obedience. It teaches obedience to all established governmental authorities. Not that they are to be actively obeyed when they command something that religion forbids, but they aren't to be resisted, let alone rebelled against, for any amount of wrong to ourselves. And while in the morality of the best pagan nations there's a place, indeed too large a place, for positive duty to the state, in purely Christian ethics that grand department of duty is scarcely noticed or acknowledged. It is in the Koran, not the New Testament, that we read the maxim, "A ruler who appoints any man to an office when another man in his dominions is better qualified for it, sins against God and against the state." Modern morality almost ignores the idea of obligation to the public, and what little recognition it does give to it comes from Greek and Roman sources, not from Christian ones. Just as in the morality of private life, whatever there is in the way of magnanimity, high-mindedness, personal dignity, even the sense of honour, is derived from the purely human and not the religious part of our education, and never could have grown out of a standard of ethics in which the only officially recognised value is that of obedience. I fully concede that there could be forms of Christian ethics that were free of these defects, and that Christian ethics could be made consistent with the many requisites of a complete moral doctrine that it doesn't actually contain. And I would say this even more strenuously about the doctrines and precepts of Christ himself. I believe that his sayings are everything they were apparently intended to be, that they can be reconciled with anything that a comprehensive morality requires, that everything excellent in ethics can be brought within their scope, with no more violence to their language than has been done in attempts to deduce from them other practical systems of conduct. But it is quite consistent with this to believe that the sayings of Christ contain only a part of the truth, and weren't meant to contain more, that many essential elements of the highest morality are not, and were not intended to be, provided for in his recorded sayings, and have been entirely thrown aside in the system of ethics that the Christian Church has erected on the basis of those sayings. So I think it a great error to persist in trying to find in Christian doctrine the complete rule for our guidance, which its author intended that doctrine to endorse and enforce, but only partially to provide. I also believe that this narrow theory is becoming a grave practical evil, detracting greatly from the value of the moral training and instruction that so many well-meaning people are now at last working to promote. These people try to form minds on an exclusively religious pattern, discarding those non-religious standards that used to coexist with and supplement Christian ethics, receiving some of its spirit and giving it some of theirs. I greatly fear that this will result, that it is now resulting, in a low, abject, servile type of character, one that may submit itself to what it thinks is the supreme will, but can't rise to or feel for the conception of supreme goodness. The moral regeneration of mankind, I believe, will require that Christian ethics exist side by side with other ethical principles that can't be developed from exclusively Christian sources. The Christian system is no exception to the rule that in an imperfect state of the human mind, the interests of truth require a diversity of opinions. When men start to attend to moral truths not contained in Christianity, they need not ignore ones that it does contain. such prejudice or oversight, when it occurs, is altogether bad. Still, we can't hope to avoid it altogether, and it must be regarded as the price to be paid for an incalculable good. When one part of the truth is claimed to be the whole of it, this is sure to be protested against. And if the protester's sense of the unfairness of this makes them unjust, this one-sidedness may be lamented, just as the other was. But it must be tolerated. If Christians want to teach unbelievers to be fair to Christianity, they should themselves be fair to unbelief. Much of the noblest and most valuable moral teaching has been the work not only of men who didn't know the Christian faith, but also of men who knew and rejected it. Anyone who has the most ordinary acquaintance with literary history knows this. Ignoring it can't do the truth any service. I don't claim that the most unlimited use of freedom in expressing all possible opinions would put an end to the evils of religious or philosophical sectarianism. Every truth that men with limited minds are in earnest about is sure to be asserted, taught, and in many ways even acted on, as if no other truth existed in the world, or anyway none that could limit or restrict the first. All opinions tend to become sectarian, and I admit that very free discussion is not a cure for this. Indeed, discussion heightens and worsens sectarianism. Truth that ought to be seen may be rejected all the more violently, because it is proclaimed by people regarded by the sectarians as opponents. But it is not on the impassioned partisan, but rather on the calmer and less self-interested bystander, that this collision of opinions has a healthy effect. The really threatening evil is not the violent conflict between parts of the truth, but the quiet suppression of half of it. When people are forced to listen to both sides, there are grounds for hope. It's when they attend to only one side that errors harden into prejudices, and truth itself stops acting like truth because it comes to be exaggerated into falsehood. Very few people have the mental capacity to sit in intelligent judgment between two sides of a question when only one is represented by an advocate. Because of the scarcity of people with that much mental capacity, truth has no chance except to the extent that every side of it, every opinion embodying any fraction of it, has advocates who can make themselves heard. Before leaving the topic of freedom of opinion, I should discuss the view that the free expression of all opinions should be permitted on condition that the expression is temperate and doesn't exceed the bounds of fair discussion. How are these supposed bounds to be fixed? Is the criterion that the bounds have been passed if those whose opinion is attacked are offended? That would be useless, because experience shows that offence is given whenever the attack is telling and powerful, and that every opponent who pushes them hard, and whom they find it difficult to answer, appears to them to be intemperate. This point merges into a more fundamental objection to the demand for temperateness in debate. Undoubtedly, the manner of asserting an opinion, even a true one, may be very objectionable and may rightly incur severe criticism. But the principal offences in the manner of conducting a debate are such that it is usually impossible to convict the offender unless he accidentally gives himself away. The most serious offence is to argue invalidly, to suppress facts or arguments, to misstate the elements of the case, or misrepresent the opposite opinion. But all this is continually done, often to an extreme, in perfect good faith by people who aren't regarded as ignorant or incompetent, and in many other respects may not be ignorant or incompetent, so that there are seldom adequate grounds for a conscientious accusation of morally culpable misrepresentation. And still less could there be laws against this kind of misconduct in controversy. As for what is commonly meant by intemperate discussion, namely invective, sarcasm, personal insults, and the like, the denunciation of these weapons of debate would deserve more sympathy if it were proposed, even-handedly, to forbid them to both sides. But in practice, it is desired to restrain the use of them only against the prevailing opinion. Against the unprevailing opinion, they may not only be used without general disapproval, but will be likely to lead to the person's being praised for his honest zeal and righteous indignation. Yet these weapons of debate do most harm when used against the comparatively defenceless, and publicly accepted opinions are almost the only ones that get an unfair advantage from being defended in this way. The worst offence of this kind that can be committed by a controversialist is to brand those who hold the contrary opinion as bad and immoral men. Those who hold some unpopular opinion are especially vulnerable to such slander, because usually they are few and uninfluential, and nobody else feels much interest in seeing justice done to them. But from the nature of the case, they can't use this weapon against defenders of a prevailing opinion. It wouldn't be safe for them to use it, and anyway, it wouldn't achieve anything for them, and would merely reflect back on their own cause. In general, opinions contrary to the commonly accepted ones can obtain a hearing only by carefully moderate language, and the most cautious avoidance of unnecessary offence, from which they hardly ever deviate, even slightly, without losing ground. Whereas unmeasured abuse, employed on the side of the prevailing opinion, really does deter people from proclaiming contrary opinions, and from listening to those who proclaim them. In the interest of truth and justice, therefore, it is far more important to restrain this employment of abusive language than the other. For example, if we had to choose, there would be much more need to discourage offensive attacks on unbelief than offensive attacks on religion. But it is obvious that law and authority have no business restraining either of them. What we should all do is to base our verdict on the circumstances of the individual case, condemning anyone, on either side of the argument, whose mode of advocacy shows lack of candour, or malignity, bigotry, or intolerance of feeling. But we shouldn't infer these vices from the side that a person takes in the debate, even if it is opposite to our own. And we should give deserved honour to everyone, whatever opinion he may hold, who has the calmness to see, and the honesty to state, what his opponents and their opinions really are, exaggerating nothing to their discredit, and not suppressing anything that might count in their favour. This is the real morality of public discussion. And even if it is often violated, I am glad there are many controversialists who, to a great extent, observe it, and even more who conscientiously try to do so. End of chapter 2.